35-year-old Deanne Hastings was putting her life back together. After a long battle with bipolar disorder, a divorce, and treatment at an inpatient facility, she was finally coming back out of the darkness. Engaged now to a man who made her happy, connecting with her son and making plans for the future, everything seemed to be exactly as she wanted it to be. On November 3rd, 2015, Deanne completed her first day of cosmetology school, came home, hung out with her son's girlfriend, and talked about how excited she was. Later, she scribbled a note to her fiancé, left to go to a nearby store, and never returned. When her fiancé came home and found her absent, at first, he thought nothing of it. But as hours began passing, his concern would grow. Tracking down her cell phone using GPS, her fiancé, Mike Tibbetts, found her vehicle parked in a rough part of town. To his surprise, when he called Deanne's phone, he could hear it ringing inside of her car. This set off alarm bells, and soon Mike, Deanne's family, and the Spokane Police Department were involved. The investigation would raise many questions about Deanne's state of mind at the time of her disappearance, as well as questions about her fiancé and several individuals seen in her company, one of whom would later be found using her credit card. The last people seen with Deanne claimed she was left on a hillside just 300 yards from her home. The story just doesn't make any sense. What happened to Deanne Hastings? Did she find herself once again suffering from a mental health issue which disoriented her? Or did someone take advantage of the young mother and is now concealing the terrible truth? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 73, The Vanishing of Deanne Hastings. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the disturbing disappearance of Deanne Hastings from Spokane, Washington, in November of 2015. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances, examining a different case each Monday. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter at TraceEvPod, on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. You can visit the website at trace-evidence.com for full episodes, social media links, merchandise, and much more. Trace Evidence is also on Patreon, so if you would like to support the show, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence. where you can get rewards such as stickers, pins, and commercial-free episodes. There's also a PayPal donation link on the website for those of you who don't wish to go through Patreon. This show is a complete one-man operation, and your support is greatly appreciated. Today we examine the disappearance of Deanne Hastings. It's a sad story, with underpinnings of mental illness exacerbated by unanswered questions and a lack of evidence. This is Episode 73, The Vanishing of Deanne Hastings. Deanne Marie Kreider was born on February 27, 1980 in Pahrump, Nevada. Deanne was the family's second child, with her older brother Carson having been born nearly 3 years earlier. Pahrump is an unincorporated town in Nye County, covering 364 square miles with a population of just over 36,000. The locals were relatively spread out, with there being large swaths of land between residences. It wasn't uncommon for the nearest neighbor to be several miles away, but this provided Deanne and Carson with a giant sandbox to play in, and they certainly went about enjoying every moment of it. According to Carson, they had an amazing childhood thanks to having great parents. This was, in part, due to the fact that their parents were very actively involved in their lives. Deanne's mother, Patricia, later explained, quote, "We would go every place together, on picnics and hikes and bike rides. We were always a team," end quote. It's clear from friends and family how tight-knit they all were, supporting one another, having fun, and spending as much time together as they could. They were, in a sense, the quintessential American family. From an early age, Deanne's intelligence and tenderness was apparent. She was very caring and loving to those around her. She was also a beautiful little girl from day one, and as she grew, it only became more apparent that someday she was going to knock the boys out. But it wasn't all just about a pretty smile and styled hair for Deanne. She wasn't afraid to get down in the dirt, pick up lizards, swing sticks like swords, and jump from tall rocks and hills. Patricia later defined Deanne as amazing, brilliant, talented, and fearless. Her brilliance was apparent in school, where she consistently earned high marks and praise from her teachers. While Pahrump had offered the family a calm, quiet, and isolated environment in which to be together, around the time Deanne was entering fourth grade, the family packed up their belongings and moved to Spokane, Washington, some 1,200 miles to the north. Spokane is quite different from Nevada in everything from climate to population and layout. While Pahrump had been spread out and vast, Spokane was smaller and more condensed, with over 200,000 residents living in just 60 square miles. Just 92 miles south of the Canadian border and 18 from the neighboring state of Idaho, it certainly offered a vastly different experience than what they were all used to. And yet, the children loved the new city, and Washington seemed to agree with the family. Here, the kids would now have the chance to grow up in a more typical American structure, with the nearest houses right across the street, rather than miles down the road. While the transition to Spokane had been easy, and Deanne was thriving in her new environment, things would take a dramatic shift in 1996, when Deanne was 15 years old. It was at this time that, while her brother was preparing to move to Texas, as he was joining the Navy, Deanne's parents informed the kids that they'd be separating. Deanne took it hard, and according to Patricia, quote, "After that, she really turned. It's like something in her spirit broke," end quote. Deanne's father moved out, Carson went down to Texas, and for a time, it was just Deanne and Patricia living together. Patricia would later describe Deanne as not only her daughter, but her best friend. The two shared everything with one another, and while the circumstances may not have been optimal, this did seem to bring mother and daughter closer together. While it was just the two women in the home, all of that was going to change. When Deanne was 17, she visited her mother at work during a lunch break. It was here that Deanne would tell Patricia the news. She was pregnant with her first child, a son she'd go on to name Hayden. Hayden's father was a young man Deanne had been seeing. They were in school together. While the two were still just high school teenagers, this didn't impact their dedication to being good parents. And when Hayden was born in July of 1998, both parents would work hard to provide a good environment for their son. Part of this would include Deanne moving in with the father of her son. They would raise Hayden under the same roof and spend the next 9 years together. After nearly a decade together, with the young couple having transitioned into their mid-20s, issues had arisen that could no longer be controlled, and they agreed to separate. This was a difficult blow for Deanne, who had struggled so mightily when her own parents separated. Ultimately, the 27-year-old would return to live with her mother. It was also around this time that Deanne would be diagnosed with bipolar disorder, which, while providing some insight into issues Deanne had experienced throughout her life, would slowly spin out of control, despite her efforts to keep the mental health issue at bay. Unfortunately, even with the diagnosis, treatment options simply didn't seem to be working, and Deanne began to experience what her family has since referred to as episodes. Patricia described these episodes by explaining, quote, "She would have periods where I almost didn't recognize her, and I was afraid of what was happening to her. Sometimes she would come back and she would be Deanne, and she would be bright and happy and lovely, and then other times, most of the time, she was very difficult. So it was, I had just lost my best friend. I lost my daughter," end quote. These times were extremely difficult for both Patricia and Deanne, both of whom were struggling to find the answers. Patricia began researching bipolar disorder and every possible option she could find to help quell the storm inside of Deanne's mind, but little, if anything, worked. During these episodes, Deanne would feel ashamed of her behavior, aware that she was hurting those she loved. In order to help set her head straight and to save her loved ones from her behavior, Deanne would disappear for a handful of days at a time. Carson explained it, saying, quote, "She would disappear for 2 or 3 days, and she was doing that because she didn't want people to see her like that. And then she would come out of the episode, and she would be absolutely drained and would sleep, and then would apologize and feel embarrassed for everything that she did." End quote. These episodes typically lasted only a few days, during which time Deanne would be out of sight, but not unreachable. She always kept her phone with her, would sporadically answer text messages, and mostly be overly apologetic in her responses. She tried everything. Counseling, medication, therapy, but nothing seemed to work. Whatever the combination was to how this particular disorder affected her, nobody could quite crack it. As a result of these episodes, the decision was made to send Hayden to live with his father. Deanne could see him anytime she wanted, but the unpredictability of her bipolar simply made it impossible for her to be safely alone with her son. It was around this time that the decision was made for Deanne to travel south, to live with her brother in Texas for a time, to try and get things under control, to create a fresh start. The family hoped a change of environment might be good for her mind and body. Remarkably, the change of scenery really seemed to help. Soon Deanne's episodes became fewer and further between. She started to put the pieces of her life back together, and the bright, bubbly, and loving young woman began to blossom. Texas seemed to agree with her, and while she was there, she finished up school to be a nurse's assistant. While Texas provided a new world for Deanne to explore, it would also introduce her to a new love. Randy was in boot camp and a friend of Carson's. And when he met Deanne, it was clear there was something special between them. Carson was excited as he thought highly of Randy and saw how well he treated his sister. Inside of 6 months, the couple decided to move in together, and just 3 months later, they made the decision to get married. Together, they would have a son and a daughter, and while things had been going so well, Deanne's episodes would suddenly return. At first, the episodes weren't as intense and were able to be controlled, but with each subsequent occurrence, they'd become stronger. Soon the strain these episodes put on the marriage became too much to bear, and after 9 years together, Deanne and Randy decided to go their separate ways. Randy, though, was concerned. Being in the military, he could be deployed anywhere, at any time, and this would leave Deanne as the sole parent raising their two young children. If her episodes continued to worsen, there was a concern about their safety. At that time, the decision was made that Deanne would return to Washington, where she and her two young children would move in with Patricia. Unfortunately, the return to Washington didn't seem to help with her issues, and soon, Deanne was experiencing the worst episodes of her life. It was at this time she made the decision to seek additional help. Crossing the border into Idaho, Deanne checked herself into an inpatient treatment facility. She wanted control of her life back, to find the solution to this issue, put a stop to the episodes, and most importantly, to earn back the right to raise her children on her own. Deanne's choice showed not only how determined she was to correct the issue, but how aware she was of what it was doing not only to herself, but to those she loved. For her family, it was a relief. They felt that finally, maybe the secret of Deanne's bipolar could finally be uncovered, and with additional medications and therapy, they might find a way to return balance to her life. Upon completion of the program, Deanne seemed to be much improved. She returned to Washington, going to Spokane instead of back to her mother's. She needed to live on her own for a while, to be able to take care of herself, before she felt ready to take on the responsibility of raising the kids. Patricia lived just an hour away from Spokane, and Deanne was in constant contact with her two young ones, as well as her oldest son, Hayden, who lived in town with his father. During this time, Deanne began seeing her son more, spending time with him, and it appeared that after such a struggle against the dark veil of bipolar, Deanne was finally back in control. Deanne was working hard, taking her meds, continuing outpatient counseling. She seemed to be thriving once again, and the bright, beautiful, and loving young woman she'd always been was returning. Her family noticed the change and were extremely happy for her. Things began falling into place when Deanne met and fell in love with a friend of a friend, Mike Tibbetts. It was, essentially, love at first sight, the way Mike tells it. They just clicked and were drawn to one another. Their relationship developed rapidly, and Deanne seemed happy and healthy. At one point, she placed a call to her brother and explained to him how in love she was, how happy she was, that she was enjoying her life with Mike, wanted to get married again, and was hopeful about her future prospects, including controlling her bipolar and bringing her children back home. Around this same time, Deanne decided to pursue a new career, enrolling in cosmetology school. She'd always loved doing nails, makeup, making others feel beautiful. Now, it would be her career. But sadly, Deanne would only attend a single day of cosmetology school. By November of 2015, 35-year-old Deanne and her now fiancé, Mike, were living together. There was intense talk of marriage, with both eager to take the first steps into their new life together. At the time, Mike worked as a project manager for an HVAC company, bringing home an income that gave him the ability to help carry much of the load while Deanne attended school. Tuesday, November 3rd, was set to be Deanne's first day at school, and from the moment she got up, it was obvious how excited she was. Mike later described Deanne that morning, saying, quote, "She was spunky. She was ready to go. She was happy. I mean, she was getting ready and running around, and she was excited." End quote. Deanne would be attending the Glendow Academy, known in the area as a good institution for heading down the road of cosmetology. According to Deanne, her first day went amazingly well, and she returned home that evening, excited and hopeful. Mike was working that night. He often worked the 12 p.m. to 10 p.m. shift, and Deanne would return to an empty house, but not for long. Hayden, now 17, had been dating a young woman named Melanie, and the young couple were struggling a bit. They were still young, but had important decisions to make, and at the time, Hayden, it seemed, was a little hesitant to make the full commitment. Melanie, who had grown close to Deanne in the previous months, stopped by to visit, to talk to her about the relationship, and to get her nails done. Deanne loved Melanie, and explained to her that they'd work things out, and that one day, she would be her daughter-in-law. But that even in the worst-case scenario, if they broke up, she'd always be there for Melanie, and she would always see her as a surrogate daughter. Melanie left the home at approximately 9:30 p.m., with Deanne telling her to drive safely and to text her when she got home, which Melanie did. She received a text back from Deanne thanking her for letting her know she was home, telling her she loved her and that she'd see her soon. Sadly, neither Melanie nor any of Deanne's family would ever see her again. When Mike arrived home just 30 minutes to an hour later, he found the house empty. He came across a note, allegedly written by Deanne, which explains that she'd had a good day, just finished doing Melanie's nails, and was going to make a run to the store, located just 5 miles away. Mike thinks little of this until hours begin passing and Deanne hasn't returned. At approximately 11:30 p.m., some 2 hours after Deanne was last seen, Mike decided to drive down to the store, wondering if perhaps Deanne had experienced car trouble along the way. Mike didn't see Deanne anywhere along the way, and when he arrived at the store, it was closed. There was no sign of Deanne or her car at the store, so Mike began driving around looking for his fiancé. Finally, around 2:30 in the morning, Mike realized that he could actually track the location of Deanne's phone through their account. Upon receiving the GPS coordinates, Mike began driving towards them, but soon found himself entering a part of Spokane that can be a little rough. He found Deanne's vehicle parked in a public parking lot at 919 West Sprague Avenue, directly across the street from the Knitting Factory, part of a small national chain of venues where musicians, comedians, and other entertainers put on shows, as well as there being a bar. When Mike arrived at the car at approximately 3 a.m., he immediately went to inspect it. He found the doors locked, and he doesn't have a copy of Deanne's keys, so all he could do was peer inside the windows. Nothing appeared to be amiss or out of order, and since the car was there, Mike assumed Deanne must be nearby. Knowing that she never goes anywhere without her phone, Mike figured he might have just missed her, and so he takes out his own phone and calls, but then his stomach drops. From inside the car, Mike can hear Deanne's phone ringing, and when he peers back through the window, he can see the glow of her phone emanating from inside of her purse, which has also been left inside the car. Without a way to get into the car, or any idea of where Deanne might be, Mike decided to wait there, assuming she'd be back. Mike was still waiting in the parking lot when the sun came up on Wednesday, November 4th, and sometime close to 8 a.m., he decided to make a call to the cosmetology school, wondering if by some chance Deanne had made it there. It's at this time he was informed that Deanne did not arrive for her second day of school. When he explained the situation to the man from the Glendow Academy, the man made Mike an offer to help run off some missing persons flyers for him to get them put up around town. Mike agreed, and while the flyers were being printed, he gathered a few friends and together they all went around town, putting up the flyers on every surface they could stick them to. Mike figured the sooner they can get the word out, the sooner they can find Deanne. While papering the town, Mike received an alert from the credit card company that one of their cards was being used at the grocery store, the Trading Company. In the small town of Cheney, located approximately 15 miles southwest of Spokane. For whatever reason, though, Mike elected not to head to the store. Instead, he stakes out Deanne's car, assuming that since she's been to the grocery store, she'll come back to drive home. This is a decision he will later regret, and one of several which will raise questions for investigators. I should note, according to maps and documents I've examined, this particular store was not located near Deanne's vehicle, though it was later expressed that Mike returned to her vehicle because it was only 4 miles from the store. Not sure of the reason for this discrepancy, but according to my research, the distance from the car to this store is 15.5 miles. I've seen the address of the store given as both 4235 Cheney Spokane Road, but the official website lists it as 4 Cheney Spokane Road. Deanne never arrived back at her car, and after several hours of waiting, Mike finally made the decision to drive to the store where he hoped to find either Deanne or someone who might be able to confirm seeing her, and possibly even her whereabouts at the time. Mike, still carrying a stack of missing persons flyers, walked through the store's parking lot but sees no sign of Deanne. When he spots a male employee nearby, he showed him one of the flyers, which according to Mike, the man replied by saying she looked familiar, but he wasn't sure. Mike headed inside and noticed that the store had a surveillance system, and so he spoke to a supervisor requesting permission to review the tape from earlier that day. After explaining the situation, Mike was told they couldn't show him the footage without their boss's approval, so they took down his number and told him they'd call him when the boss came in. The next day, Thursday, November 5th, after Deanne has been missing for more than 36 hours, Mike finally decides to contact the Spokane Police Department, where he files a missing persons report. According to Mike, he was told that the report would be entered into the system and assigned to a detective. In later interviews, he expressed that he felt once he discussed Deanne's previous mental health issues with authorities, they became somewhat dismissive of the case, believing that it was likely another episode and that Deanne would return as she always did. According to the department, they don't consider missing persons cases a top priority as they often resolve themselves, whatever that means. An investigator would not begin looking into the case until Monday, November 8th, 5 days after Deanne was last seen. Washington, I should note, is one of the top 5 states for missing persons, ranking at number 4, with more than 643 open cases, many of which center around densely populated areas, such as Spokane and the Spokane Valley. After filing the report and feeling brushed off, Mike didn't know what to do. On the one hand, he felt he should contact Deanne's family, but he also didn't want to worry them if this was just going to turn out to be another episode. So Mike made a choice. Instead of reaching out to the family, he contacted the media, telling them this story and providing them with flyers and photos of Deanne. Reports were run in the days following this, many of which resulted in phone calls and tips. Unfortunately, by electing not to tell Deanne's family first, her brother Carson found out that his sister was missing when a friend called and asked him about it. Carson later stated, quote, "I figured Deanne was having another manic episode, and that was my initial thought, that she'll be back in a day or two," end quote. Carson, having been through this before, knew not to freak out just yet, but when he notified their mother, Patricia felt differently. For reasons passing understanding, perhaps a mother's intuition, Patricia thought something was wrong. One factor contributing to this is that when Deanne knew things were going bad, she would disappear for days, but she'd always notify her family first and would keep her phone on her. This time, no one was told, and in fact, one of the last text messages she sent was delivered at approximately 10 p.m. on the night she vanished. This text was sent to Hayden and merely stated that she'd had a good first day at school and hoped he was proud of her. On Saturday, November 6th, Mike received a call from the grocery store manager who invited him down to view the surveillance footage. Scanning the footage starting a little before 12 p.m., Deanne appeared on camera rather quickly. According to Mike, he found the footage disturbing. Deanne appeared to be moving somewhat erratically, making gestures with her hands, and she's consistently looking over her shoulder as if she's being watched or believes she is. What makes the visit to the store even more bizarre are the items that Deanne purchased, which include 4 energy drinks, cigarettes, string cheese, candles for a birthday cake, and a bottle of vodka. While this certainly seems strange and may indicate that Deanne was not in the right state of mind at the time, it's the accounts of several witnesses in the area that will truly concern Mike and Deanne's family. This particular grocery store is part of a strip mall. A woman working in a salon in that strip mall reported that Deanne had walked into the salon and seemed to be out of sorts. At various points in time, she addressed the woman as Mommy, and it was clear that she was not well. She was telling a story that didn't make a great deal of sense, but one detail which the witness remembers clearly is that Deanne made multiple statements suggesting that someone had drugged and kidnapped her. This incident took place sometime between 11:30 a.m. and 12 p.m. The next sighting was just a few minutes later, when 2 women saw Deanne sitting nearby and behaving oddly. They asked if she needed help, offered to call family, or even to give her a ride home, but they found Deanne resistant and confrontational, so they called 911. The Spokane Police Department responded by sending out an officer, Davida Zinkgraf, for a welfare check. According to Officer Zinkgraf, by the time she arrived, EMTs were on the scene, and while they were treating Deanne, they found her to be defensive and resistant to help. Zinkgraf tried to engage Deanne multiple times, but Deanne had little she wished to say to the officer, even refusing to disclose her name, though she did make several statements alleging to have been beaten and assaulted. Deanne allegedly also told Zinkgraf, as well as others, that she had been drugged and abducted. Officer Zinkgraf thought Deanne may have been drunk. She saw no physical signs of assault, and several minutes after she arrived, Deanne stood up and began walking away, heading towards a nearby coffee shop, and Officer Zinkgraf let her go. Officer Zinkgraf explained that she sat in her patrol car watching Deanne walk towards the coffee shop, and after several minutes, she decided to leave the area. When the family learned of this report, they were extremely upset that the officer had done nothing to help Deanne, though Officer Zinkgraf later stated, quote, "We don't have a public intoxication law here in Spokane, and since she seemed to be able to take care of herself, I didn't have a lawful reason to detain her," end quote. This is a controversial issue for those who love Deanne, feeling that there's no way, with her behaving the way that she was, that anyone could believe she was able to take care of herself, let alone not a danger to herself or others. She mentioned being drugged, abducted, and assaulted. For some reason, she was not brought in. this will turn out to be a fateful decision. This will not be the last sighting of Deanne, though. On Sunday, November 7th, Mike received a bizarre phone call just a little after 6 a.m. A man on the other end stated that not only did he recognize Deanne, but he claimed to have been with her the night she disappeared. In a bizarre turn of events, the man making this call is in fact the same employee who Mike, days earlier, had shown Deanne's flyer to in the grocery store parking lot. He alleges that, at the time, he thought the woman on the flyer looked like the woman he had spent time with the previous night, but that he wasn't sure. Essentially, no one believes that, but Mike agrees to meet with him to discuss what information he may have. The meeting takes place between 10:30 and 11 a.m., and Mike brought his sister along with him. According to the man, he met Deanne when he walked out of the knitting factory to have a cigarette and found her standing on the sidewalk. The man went on to explain that he engaged Deanne in conversation, she seemed polite, and he didn't initially detect anything wrong. He offered her a cigarette, which she accepted, and the two talked some more. In this first telling of the story, the man explains that Deanne came home and spent the night with him, though at the time he claimed he had a girlfriend and nothing sexual had occurred between he and Deanne. He then alleges that, the next morning, he drove Deanne to the grocery store where he worked, and he went inside to buy cigarettes while she waited in the car. When he returned, he claimed Deanne was nowhere to be found. He would later claim Deanne stole his cell phone also. After looking around for a few minutes, the man drove home only later to discover Deanne's car keys in his vehicle. Mike has since stated that the man struck him as weird. He didn't buy the whole story, and he felt there was more to it. When investigators later spoke to this man, he basically told the same story, except this time, he included the detail that he and Deanne had drank together and also smoked marijuana. Feeling frustrated with this story, but now in possession of Deanne's keys, for some reason, Mike proceeded over to her vehicle, unlocking it and driving it home. Inside, he found Deanne's purse, cell phone, and wallet, though he notes multiple credit cards are missing. The choice to enter and move the vehicle is yet another strange detail noted by investigators, as they feel, were there any information or forensic evidence in the vehicle, it would now be tainted or destroyed. After driving Deanne's car home, Mike couldn't help but get more and more angry and frustrated over the story the man had told him earlier in the day. Thinking about what Deanne was telling everyone, he begins to wonder if it's possible that the guy had drugged Deanne at the knitting factory and then taken her home and assaulted her. After placing a few calls, Mike and two friends arrived at the man's apartment. Banging on the door and calling his name, the man finally answered. Mike explained that he would like to look through the apartment for any signs of Deanne, to which the man agreed, though Mike would later explain he didn't give him much of a choice because he was getting in there no matter what. After thoroughly looking through every room and examining every angle of the apartment, Mike saw nothing that belonged to Deanne, and he had no sign of her either. In what many have considered a suspicious move, the man left Washington State, returning to his home state of Florida fairly rapidly after Deanne's disappearance. Overwhelmed and confounded, Mike drove around town for hours looking for Deanne, as he did every night. On Monday, November 8th, Deanne's file finally falls onto the desk of Detective Jeff Barrington of the Spokane Police Department's Major Crimes Unit. After familiarizing himself with the details, Barrington's first decision is to pull Deanne's phone records, though he finds nothing suspicious in them, and even pings issued on her phone reveal nothing since she had left it behind in her car. His next idea was to monitor Deanne's credit cards, and this choice paid dividends just a few days later. From the period of Sunday, November 7th to Thursday the 12th, Deanne's cards had been used multiple times, all around Spokane and the Spokane Valley. The cards were mostly used in convenience stores, pharmacies, and grocery stores. Tracking the usage of the cards, Detective Barrington is able to view the surveillance footage in a Wilco store at the time of one of the transactions, revealing the person using Deanne's cards, and it definitely wasn't Deanne. In the footage, a light-skinned male dressed in a black hooded sweater with yellow lines and a black hat can be seen. Additional footage shows the same man exiting the store with two other individuals. Barrington released the photos to the press, and within the first hour, multiple calls came in identifying the man as Randy Riley. A quick check of the system showed that Riley had been arrested before and had a minor criminal record. He mainly seemed to live on the streets, though there is an address. But unfortunately, when Barrington calls, he finds out Riley had recently been evicted. At this point, Riley could be anywhere. In addition to identifying Riley, multiple witnesses called in reporting to have seen Deanne in the company of Riley and another man, and possibly a woman. Piecing together the sightings, Barrington is able to determine that after leaving the grocery store, Deanne traveled approximately 2 blocks until she was near a storage unit facility. Here, Deanne encounters Riley and another man before all three walk into the storage unit area. All three can then be seen on surveillance cameras exiting the facility at 1:30 p.m. Several weeks after her disappearance, on November 25th, Riley's former landlord reported seeing Deanne with the two men around 2:30. And according to her, Deanne was lying in the road at the time. This is corroborated by an independent witness who lived in the area. According to her statement, she saw Deanne seemingly out of it with two men, and so she stopped and asked if she was all right. Allegedly, Deanne responded that she was going through a divorce and having a rough time. The woman noted that Deanne appeared to be intoxicated, but felt her answers were normal, and she didn't say anything that made her feel like there was a major problem, and so she drove off. In an attempt to track down Riley, now with evidence that Deanne was last seen in his company, Detective Barrington visits his mother, with whom he has stayed at various points in time. During the discussion with the mother, she suggests that the detective visit a local restaurant that Riley is known to frequent. Barrington headed down towards the restaurant, and to his luck, he found Randy Riley hanging around outside. At this time, Riley was questioned, and initially, he tells a story that seems somewhat believable. According to Riley, he and his friend, James, met Deanne near the storage unit. The three spent the day hanging out together and drinking. Riley alleges that Deanne gave him her credit cards and told him to go get himself something to eat. When asked about Deanne's whereabouts, Riley claims to have no knowledge. Barrington believes some of the story, though he's highly skeptical about the credit card part of it. Several weeks after her disappearance, Deanne's license was found in downtown Spokane, outside of Sonnenberg's Deli. At first, this sparked hope, with some believing that Deanne may still be wandering around, just not knowing what is truly happening and experiencing an episode. This hope, however, will be dashed the next month when Randy Riley speaks to investigators again. On December 10th, Riley was officially charged with second-degree identity theft and possession of stolen property. This time, he's brought in for an official interview, and he changes some of the details in his story. Now he claims that Deanne had gone up the hill to relieve herself in a bush and never come back. Then, the following day, as he and James were driving by, moving Riley's belongings out of the apartment he was evicted from, they pass by the area where Deanne had previously been. Riley claims they found her coat and shoes there. They stopped, picked up the items, and found Deanne's credit cards in the pocket of her coat. Essentially, if true, this would mean that Deanne elected to remove her jacket and shoes while in the frigid temperatures of Spokane in November. When asked about Deanne's license, Riley actually confesses that he's the one who threw it down in front of the deli. Investigators couldn't help but wonder why you would do this specifically to make them believe Deanne was still alive. Barrington leans hard on Riley, but he swears up and down that the last time he saw Deanne, she was alive and well. He will ultimately plead guilty to his charges and be sentenced to 13 months in prison. Having nowhere to go with Riley, Barrington next spoke to James, who essentially told the same story as Riley, though some of the details were different. James claims that when Deanne went up the hill to relieve herself in a bush, he went to check on her after a few minutes, but she didn't want to move from that spot. He says he went back down the hill, told Riley, and Riley went up to check on Deanne. According to James, Riley was up there for 5 to 10 minutes before coming back down, alone. James did not see Deanne after that. What is truly disturbing about all of this is that the bush and the hill where the men showed investigators that all of this took place was just over 300 yards from Deanne's home. Riley claimed Deanne said she was going home. If that was her plan, she almost made it, but what stopped her? Barrington examined the area and organized a search. To aid with the search, investigators were brought in to search on foot with the assistance of cadaver dogs. All the while, a plane was flown over the area multiple times, utilizing cameras with heat sensors. Despite a vast search covering a large swath of land, nothing was found. No signs of Deanne, no signs of a crime, not even a single shred of clothing. For Barrington, he didn't quite know what to make of it. Stuck in a dead end where he's suspicious of Riley and James, but has no evidence, he began to look for other possibilities, and this led him to examine Mike Tibbetts, Deanne's fiancé. While Mike had told investigators that he and Deanne were happy and there were no issues, several people contradicted this, including Melanie and Deanne's best friend, Amanda Ladd. While they didn't know details, both women explained that Deanne had reported multiple arguments and confrontations with Mike in recent weeks. Amanda actually provided Detective Barrington with text messages she received from Deanne. One of these texts, dated October 20th, just 2 weeks before her disappearance, states, quote, "I want out, honestly, Amanda. I'm 99% sure he drugged me the other night," end quote. Amanda claims Deanne had wanted to leave Mike for weeks. In regard to this message about being drugged, Deanne also claimed to have visited a doctor to be tested, though it's been said that the doctors didn't find anything and didn't really believe her story. Barrington said he was also suspicious of Mike because of several acts he found strange. Firstly, that Mike had stayed at the car instead of going to the store when he was notified that the credit card had been used. Secondly, that he delayed notifying the family. And thirdly, that he had moved the vehicle. However, what really bothered the detective was Mike's apparent unwillingness to turn over items which could assist investigators. Barrington claims he requested both Deanne's cell phone and the note she left the night she disappeared, both of which are in Mike's possession, both of which he refused to turn over. In his defense, Mike claimed that the note was the last thing Deanne had written him, and there were pictures on the phone of the two of them, and he was afraid if he turned these items over, he might not get them back. In regard to the mentions of being drugged, well, there might actually be an explanation for that. According to Mike, in the weeks leading up to her disappearance, it was clear that Deanne was struggling with her mental illness. Mike claims that Deanne told him she believed the neighbors were drugging their water supply, that an ex-boyfriend was trying to kill her, and at various times, she even accused him of conspiring with them. Mike described her as agitated and paranoid, signifying the onset of an episode. So why would Deanne's medication suddenly stop working, allowing for this to happen? Well, that apparently all comes down to insurance. Deanne had recently received insurance from the state to assist with medical costs and prescriptions. At the time, they notified Deanne that they were not going to pay for her meds and that she needed to take a different kind, one which they would cover. The problem was that Deanne had been on other medications and only her current ones seemed to work. She appealed the ruling, even going so far as to get a note from her doctor stating that she needed to be on that specific medication. But again, the state apparently ruled against her and denied the meds. Mike claims that he offered to pay for the meds out of pocket, bypassing the insurance altogether, but Deanne was allegedly told that if she procured medication via a third-party source, they would drop her from the insurance completely. According to Mike, Deanne hadn't been on her proper medication for a month and possibly up to 6 weeks before she disappeared. Suddenly, pieces started falling into place, but questions remained. Had Deanne been drugged, assaulted, or otherwise interfered with, or were her statements all connected to a manic episode? Unfortunately, it's difficult to know for certain, and the utter lack of evidence doesn't make the picture any less cloudy. All that is known for certain is that, when Deanne was last seen, she clearly wasn't in her right state of mind, and the last people known to have been with her were Randy Riley and his friend James. Riley was now in jail. Later, in an interview with the media while incarcerated, Riley changed his story again, this time alleging that he and James left Deanne standing on the side of the road and that they had been together for no longer than a few hours. Sadly, with nowhere to go, and now well into the month of December, the case began growing cold. Carson took on the role of family liaison with the media and law enforcement. Patricia, however, found it difficult to deal with. She was torn between going out there and trying to find Deanne and trying to maintain a stable environment for her grandchildren. Her own emotions are stirred up. She felt unable to fully deal with everything, and so she elected to back off, taking care of the kids and trying to ensure that their lives aren't disrupted. Some days, she wants to know everything Carson has to say. Other days, she just isn't emotionally strong enough to ask if there's any news. It's a difficult position for Deanne's mother. Trying to do what's best for Deanne's children is the only option she sees as a possibility for her. In January of 2016, Amanda Ladd received a message via the Deanne Hastings' missing Facebook page. The message was from James, the man who had been with Riley and Deanne. He seemed frantic and upset. He claimed to be having some sort of a mental breakdown. In the message, he was emphatic that he needed to speak with a member of the family, that he'll tell them anything they want to know. When he finally did speak with Carson, it was a confrontational discussion, and James went back to his original story, shedding no new light or information. Carson believes James wanted to confess something, but either changed his mind or was too scared to do it. On February 27th, what would have been Deanne's 36th birthday, Amanda organized a search effort. Many of Deanne's friends from high school, as well as neighbors, acquaintances, and even total strangers participated. They covered the area where Riley and James claimed Deanne was last seen. Once again, hundreds of searchers combed over every inch of that area, and once again, not a single thing was found. Carson elected not to participate in the search, stating later, quote, "I didn't want to be there if they found something, so I wasn't very hopeful," end quote. Mike would later say he had searched that area over and over again. And sadly, the case basically goes dark there. There have been no further sightings of Deanne. There's been no activity on any of her accounts. There have been no arrests or psych holds connected to her. Deanne seems to have vanished when she was so close to home. For the family, it's difficult to hold on to hope. They don't believe Deanne would just walk away from her life, but it's a possibility they would accept rather than the darker alternative. Carson, Patricia, and even Mike have made public pleas asking Deanne, if she's out there, to at least call and let them know she's all right. In the 3 years and 4 months since she was last seen, there have been no new developments, no new leads, and really no new tips. When Detective Barrington discovered, some time later, that Mike Tibbetts had since moved out of the home he shared with Deanne, he brought cadaver dogs to the residence looking for any sign of a crime, but again, nothing was found. With no new information, and not a great deal to work with to begin with, two main theories have been suggested as to what may have happened to Deanne Hastings that cold November night in 2015. The first of these theories addresses the possibility that Deanne, suffering from a manic episode, may have continued wandering on her own, eventually ending up somewhere far from home, slipping further into her mania. Many believe Deanne is still alive out there, but simply is too mentally impaired to even know that she's a missing person. It's also been considered a possibility that Deanne could have been in such a state of mental confusion that someone may have used this to their advantage to abduct the young mother. The second theory suggests that Deanne may have disappeared as the result of foul play. When it comes to this possibility, there are a handful of individuals who are considered likely assailants. James and Riley are certainly on that list, along with the man who claimed to have spent the night with Deanne. And of course, there is the possibility that her own fiancé, Mike Tibbetts, may have more information than he has shared with authorities. When last seen, Deanne Hastings was described as being a Caucasian female with natural brown hair, though it has been dyed blonde, and brown eyes, standing 5'4" tall and weighing approximately 120 pounds. Deanne has several tattoos. On her abdomen is a large flower and the names Brock, Brooklyn, and Hayden. On her lower back, she has tribal artwork. On her upper back are the sun, moon, and stars, and on her neck is Thor's hammer with several rune markings. Deanne was last seen on Inland Empire Way in Spokane, Washington on November 4th, 2015. Deanne's disappearance wasn't that long ago, and while this case is cold, it isn't quite frozen. There's still a wealth of possibilities and the hope that if someone does have any information, they may yet come forward with it. If alive today, Deanne would be 39 years old. Her children have been without her for far too long, and her oldest son did go on to marry the girl Deanne hoped would be her daughter-in-law. It was hard for the family with Deanne's absence, but they also believe she would be happy to know that her children are loved and cared for. At this point, it's a matter of waiting and hoping that either Deanne will reappear or someone will finally reveal the truth. Anyone who's had a migraine knows that they're the absolute worst. I know for me, when I have a migraine, I've got to stop doing everything, lie down in a dark room, and it can really interrupt the flow of my day. It's always difficult to deal with the discomfort and the wait to see a doctor, but now it's a little easier to treat your migraine from the comfort of your own home. With Cove, you can get treatment right from your own home. Cove starts out with a simple consultation by a licensed physician, and then the prescription they determine is best for you is sent directly to your door. After your consultation, your doctor creates and tailors your individual course of treatment. Cove then reaches out a few weeks after to see how you're feeling. Cove breaks down everything you need to know about migraines and migraine treatment. A doctor who is licensed to practice medicine in the state you live in will be the one who prescribes your monthly medication and oversees your progress. All migraine medication prescribed by the doctors at Cove is FDA approved. If you suffer from migraines, the last thing you need is to have to wait to see your doctor. With Cove, there's finally a way to get the help you need when you need it. And when you use my special link, you'll get your first month of treatment for free. Go to withcove.com/trace. That's withcove.com/trace. For your first month free, withcove.com/trace. The vanishing of Deanne Hastings is a terribly sad story to tell. A family, already racked by the difficulty and pain of watching a loved one struggle with a mental illness, now has to confront the reality that she may be never coming home. There were multiple opportunities for someone to intercede and give Deanne the assistance she needed, one of which was a police officer, and frankly, to this moment, I don't understand how you could just let her walk away when it's evidently clear something is wrong. It's just mind-blowing, but it also speaks to the state of mental health awareness in this country. Mental illness is still, in many ways, misunderstood and treated as some kind of stigma. This is not the first case I've done where improper handling of someone suffering from a psychological disorder led to disaster. Deanne was last seen by witnesses on Inland Empire Way. This is the same road that Randy Riley and his friend James claimed to have been on with Deanne when she walked up a hill to a bush to relieve herself and never came back down. The question really becomes, while we know at the time Deanne was obviously suffering from a psychological issue, was she when she left the house to go to the store? In order to really address that, let's dig into the first theory, that Deanne is out there somewhere, possibly still alive, but that her disappearance is less connected to a crime and more so associated with her mental illness, leading her to wandering off. According to the family, Deanne struggled with bipolar from around the age of 15. It wasn't officially diagnosed until she was 25, so I can't imagine during those 10 years that she was getting any kind of treatment that was actually going to help her. After the diagnosis, at least they knew what they were up against and the possible options in relation to it. The family have been pretty upfront about the fact that, for a while, Deanne was very much opposed to getting medical treatment. Instead, it's been said she would self-medicate. This is typically done with drugs or alcohol. According to Mike, in the weeks leading up to her disappearance, Deanne was not on the prescription medication that had been working for her in the past, and she was showing signs of paranoia and the onset of an episode. One question I personally have is whether or not Deanne was known to frequent the knitting factory. All indications seem to point to no, but if she was aware of that location, and it was somewhere she had been before or was comfortable going, it might explain why her car was found there. Is it possible that Deanne was going to the bar to drink specifically to self-medicate? That's a question we simply don't have the answer to. And when she later purchased vodka, we don't know if that's a self-medication choice on her part or if she's just so much into the manic state that it's just something she wanted. The knitting factory presents all kinds of questions, really. We're told this is where she met the man she spent the night with before running into Riley and James the next day. Theories abound about what he may have done, but it's really a question that needs further evaluation. If Deanne was manic at the time, and that is why she behaved the way she did, that's very different from if a person slipped something into her drink or drugged her in some way to try and take advantage of her. Deanne is a very attractive woman, and even if she weren't, there are plenty of people out there who have dark intentions and would love to take advantage of a young woman, especially one they believe is going to have a hard time convincing authorities that a crime happened at all. But we'll get more into that in the second theory. We know, in the past, that Deanne, when sinking into mania, would disappear for a few days. There's even a report from the Spokane police that Deanne was missing that summer prior to this disappearance. She didn't want to subject those she loved to her erratic, aggressive behavior. But when Deanne did this, she typically told people that she was going to do it, and kept her phone on her, maintaining some way to keep in contact if she so chose. In this instance, she didn't. But is that because something happened to her, or because this particular episode was stronger than previous ones? When coming off of medications, it can sometimes be like the dam bursting, and all that stuff they'd been holding back comes surging in. That's certainly a possibility, which can't be ignored. In terms of bipolar disorder, mania and mood changes are often referred to as cycles. A cycle is the length of time from which a person goes through mania and then the depression, or vice versa. Studies have shown that the majority of bipolar patients will experience so-called mood events that last an average of 13 weeks. Now, the cycles are typically not that frequent, with some studies showing one cycle as little as once per 5 years. However, a smaller percentage reported going through cycles as frequently as once every 3 months. Interestingly, research has shown that bipolar episodes occur more often in the spring than in the fall. I should note, there is a diagnosis for rapid cycling bipolar, which is defined as someone who goes through 4 or more cycles per year, though the rapid cycling doesn't necessarily last forever and can actually occur as little as once in someone's life. Only 2.5% of Americans are diagnosed with bipolar, and of that 2.5%, only 10 to 20% experience rapid cycling. There are triggers which can cause a cycle to occur, and these include but are not limited to disruption of sleep, arguments with loved ones, alcohol and drug abuse, some medications can make it worse, seasonal changes, pregnancy or other conditions that impact hormones, and grief. We don't know exactly how many episodes Deanne had in her life, whether she was rapid cycling or if it only happened a few times a year. However, based on the description of these cycles, they certainly seem to be more towards the extreme end of things. If that's the case, then Deanne was likely struggling with an overwhelming shifting in her mood balances. Obviously, most medications didn't help her much, but at least one did. Of course, that's apparently the medication her insurance wouldn't pay for. I'm certainly no one qualified to discuss medications or diagnoses, so I have to defer to the experts in that. For whatever reason, Deanne needed that specific medication. Taking her off of it could certainly have opened the door to a vastly more powerful episode. So, is it possible that Deanne, in a severe state of mania, just wandered off? Yeah, but the issue comes in when we examine how long it's been. Cycles are described as lasting hours, days, weeks, or even months, but I couldn't find anything that suggested they could last for years. So, were Deanne alive and out there and experiencing mania? There's a good likelihood that at some point, she cycled around and was essentially back to her normal self. So why didn't anyone hear from her? Some have considered the possibility that she may have been deeply ashamed and embarrassed, but it seems unlikely that the loving mother would just abandon her children due to shame. While Washington State and Spokane itself have large homeless populations, it also seems unlikely that if Deanne were wandering the street somewhere, that no one would have recognized her by now. No arrests, no mental health checks for strange behavior, it just doesn't add up. It's entirely possible that Deanne's disappearance is completely connected specifically with a manic episode leading to confusion, chaotic thought, auditory and visual hallucinations, paranoia, and all other forms of unpleasant mental distress. However, unless this led her into some situation which ultimately cost her life, or led her into the hands of someone who would want to harm or kidnap her, we simply can't know. Unfortunately, there are predators who would happily prey upon those who they see can't take care of themselves and are suffering from a psychological issue. Sadly, we can't rule that out here. It's entirely possible that Deanne, after leaving Riley and James, came upon someone who offered her a ride, did something to her, abducted her, kept her against her will, took her someplace she didn't know how to get back from, or perhaps this person drugged her, fed her alcohol, and kept her mind drowning in chaos. Ultimately, there's a possibility that Deanne's disappearance is entirely bipolar related, but her failure to ever surface again seems to suggest something far more sinister, and that brings us to the second theory. The second theory argues that Deanne's disappearance is entirely related to foul play. This theory has several different potential suspects involved, so in order to address it in the most efficient way, I'll take these one possible suspect at a time. We'll begin with a completely random, unknown assailant. As discussed in the previous theories, it's difficult to rule out the possibility that some total stranger could have come upon Deanne and taken advantage of the situation, abducting her under the guise of assisting her, taking control, and once Deanne was in that person's clutches and driven elsewhere, her chances of survival were quite low. She wouldn't have had the wits about her to know how to get away, let alone to possibly even realize that she was being abducted at all. Unfortunately, this is such a broad possibility, there's no way to really address it accurately without saying, yes, it's possible. In all reality, the possibilities there are fairly limitless. A passerby, someone in town, a homeless person who just happened to come upon her. Predators are in every town. However, many who examine this case believe that if Deanne did fall victim to foul play, it's more than likely we know who did it. So the first person authorities have discussed as a possibility was Deanne's fiancé, Mike Tibbetts. Most of this theory revolves around Mike's behavior in the days following Deanne's disappearance. Investigators found it strange that he moved the car, didn't go to the store when he got the call about the credit card, wouldn't hand over Deanne's phone or the note she allegedly left, and that Mike, in general, didn't seem overly cooperative with authorities. At the same time, we know that Mike felt angry with police because he believed they didn't address Deanne's case as quickly as they should have, and that they may have been prejudiced due to their knowledge of her mental health issues. When you look at the reasons why Mike was initially considered a possibility, there isn't much there. Sure, the significant other is almost always a suspect, but beyond that, there's little which seems to connect Mike to Deanne's disappearance. We know she was with Melanie until 9:30. Work records indicate that Mike didn't get off until 10, meaning he'd arrive home sometime between 10 and 10:30. According to him, Deanne was gone at this time and left a note. The note is a sticking point for a lot of people. Deanne texted people frequently. Why would she leave a note instead of texting Mike? Well, that depends partly on her state of mind. So, let's say for argument's sake that Mike did commit this crime. Then we've got a lot of questions that there are no answers for. How did he get her car down to the knitting factory, then get back home, then drive down there to check it? Especially when we consider that Deanne's keys were in someone else's possession. Beyond that, we know Deanne met someone at the knitting factory and then spent the next part of the day with Riley and James, so unless Mike somehow found Deanne after that and then committed a crime against her, all the while knowing police, her family, and the whole town were looking for her, predominantly due to him putting up flyers and contacting police, that seems like a pretty big stretch. Even Deanne's family at this point have said that Mike has told them everything they ever wanted to know, has never dodged them or avoided a question, and has appeared to be very forthcoming and involved. Authorities checked the home after Mike moved out, with cadaver dogs and other measures by which to attempt to discover if a crime had been committed there, and found nothing. Now, when you add it all up, there's pretty much nothing that connects Mike to Deanne's disappearance other than the fact that he did some stupid things, like moving the car and not handing over the phone and the note. Of course, when you weigh the evidence against what we have on other people, Mike seems pretty clean. Not to mention, he's worked hard to drum up attention for this case, has participated in searches, been part of interviews for television, and never at any time tried to distance himself from it. While Mike, for some, is a possibility, I'd have to say he's pretty far down the list. The next person to look at is the guy that says Deanne went home with him the night she disappeared. Not much is known about this guy. I'm not quite sure why his name was never revealed to the public. This seems to happen in cases from time to time, but it sure would be nice to know who we're looking at. Regardless, here's a guy whose story certainly sounds suspicious. According to him, he walks out of the knitting factory to have a cigarette, and there he just happens to find Deanne, apparently just standing there. He gives her a smoke. They talk, and apparently, he doesn't notice that something doesn't seem to be making sense here. It's hard to imagine, considering Deanne's behavior the next day, that she was completely put together here. Now, I should note, some people believe the man actually met Deanne inside the knitting factory, at which time he may have put a drug in her drink. That we can't know. Even if he met her the way he says he did, he still could have drugged her, especially if he convinced her to come home with him. So according to this guy, he and Deanne go back to his place, drink alcohol, smoke marijuana, and allegedly, nothing happens between them because he's got a girlfriend. One he apparently doesn't mind leaving when he left town rather quickly after speaking to the police. I'm not going to speculate about what may or may not have happened in that area, but it doesn't take a lot of intelligence to connect these dots. Then the next day, the guy drives her to his job where he's buying cigarettes, but he's not working. So apparently there were no gas stations or convenience stores closer for him to stop at. It doesn't really make sense, but maybe he's just comfortable shopping there or someone he works with gives him cigarettes under the table. Either way, he comes back to the car and Deanne's gone. Now, at one point he claimed that she stole his cell phone, but nothing's ever come from this, and I'd imagine if it were true, investigators could have pinged the device in hopes of finding where she was located if it was still on her. The guy also claims that he looked around for a few minutes and then just decided to drive home, at which point he finds Deanne's keys in his car. From what we know of the timeline, there's a good chance that while this guy's in the store, Deanne exits the vehicle, walks into the nearby salon, and begins the first of several strange encounters that she initiates that day. There's a pretty small window of possibility here where this guy could have returned to his car, not seen her, and driven home. Multiple witnesses in the area saw Deanne behaving strangely that day. Somehow, this guy missed it. So then, when Mike presents him with the flyer, he pretends he doesn't know Deanne. Then later he calls and tells Mike the story. On the other hand, I could see this guy freaking out that the woman he spent the night with disappeared and he could be a suspect. Maybe he was intimidated by Mike and just didn't want to tell him that he'd spent the night with his fiancée. Or maybe he had something to hide. But I don't think it's murder. For this guy to have murdered Deanne, he'd have to have found her after she spent several hours with Riley and James. It really just doesn't add up. I think there's a good possibility this guy did something. whether it was drugging Deanne and taking advantage of her, or just taking advantage of her due to her mental illness, seems like the most probable reason to lie to Mike about it. He also left out the part about smoking marijuana when he spoke to Mike, which seems to suggest he was nervous about telling the truth. Mike later goes to his apartment and looks all over it, but doesn't see anything. Sure, the guy could have gotten rid of any evidence by then, but not if he'd murdered her there. There'd likely be some indication that a crime or a struggle had taken place. While this guy certainly seems to be a scumbag, there's not much to connect him to the murder. So that leaves us with investigators, the families, bloggers, and theorists' favorite suspects in this case, Randy Riley and his friend James. We know for a fact that based on all witness accounts, these are the last people confirmed to have been seen with Deanne. We know that they drank with her, walked with her, and ended up less than 300 yards from her home. Well, we think we know that. That's just what they've told us. Considering the amount of searching that's taken place in that area, from cadaver dogs to infrared cameras to investigators and volunteers, it really doesn't seem like Deanne was there. And if she was, how the hell did she not make it 300 yards to her house? The whole story just doesn't make any sense. She goes to a bush to relieve herself and never comes back? She didn't just blink out of existence, she had to go somewhere. Surveillance cameras capture James and Riley with Deanne at the storage unit. Witnesses see them on Inland Empire Way, and then everything after that is based purely upon what Riley and James have told us. One guy, who's using her credit cards, alleging that she gave them to him, and then that he found them in her coat. The same guy who then throws her license down elsewhere in town when asked about it, specifically says he did it so people would think she was still walking around. Why would you want to do that unless you have something to hide? Let's just go back for a second. After the initial story about Deanne giving him the cards gets dismissed, and he explains that he and James went back the next day, driving by the same area they'd been with Deanne, and they find that she's gone, but her jacket and shoes are there. They pick up the items for reasons that we never get. In the jacket, they allege to find her credit cards and license. After that, they dispose of her shoes and jacket. Why did they pick them up if they were just going to throw them away? It doesn't really make any sense. In fact, it makes about as much sense as the idea that a woman would toss away her jacket and shoes in the cold weather of Spokane, Washington in November. If that's not what really happened, then what did? Well, that's difficult to answer, but many have certainly considered the possibility that Riley and James led Deanne somewhere, at which time something happened. Whether that was an assault or a sexual assault that led to murder, we simply can't know, but by and large, most people don't think Deanne was left where they claim she was. There's a good chance that one or both of these men know exactly what happened to Deanne and where she might be found. The problem is a lack of evidence to pin anything on them. The only differentiation in their stories was that Riley claims they both checked on her in the bush and she didn't want to leave, so they left. And James says that Riley checked on her, was alone, was with her for 5 to 10 minutes, and then came down the hill alone. It kind of sounds like James is trying to pin something on Riley. So are we to believe that Deanne, drunk, suffering from mania, managed to get within 300 yards of her home, and not only did no one who was looking for her notice, but she then vanished into nothing from that place, leaving behind no sign that she'd ever been there? Remember, Riley had her license. He claimed she was saying she wanted to go home. It's not like he couldn't have just picked an area to point to that he knew was close to her address. Their story has about as many holes in it as a fishing net, and yet, unfortunately, while it sounds like complete fiction to everyone, there's not much we can do about it because we've got nothing else. When you sit down and take a close look, you got two men were last seen with Deanne. They claim to have been in possession of her jacket and shoes, though they later dispose of them. One of those men used her credit cards to buy things, threw her license down to make people think she was still around, admitted to using her cards without permission, and even pled guilty to crimes for which he served time related to that. The other guy, who has never been charged with anything because he never used her cards, freaks out and wants to speak to Carson, and then all of a sudden he has nothing to say. What did James want to get off his chest that day, and what made him change his mind? Did he sober up? Hard to say, but usually if you're a possible suspect in a murder, You don't say you want to talk to a family member and you'll tell them anything and then have nothing to say. Riley, to this day, says when they left, Deanne was on the side of the road, alive and well. Of course, after these two men, not a single other person ever reports seeing Deanne. I should also note, Riley has never spoken to the family. James only spoke to Carson on the phone that one time, had nothing to say, and since then, Riley, James, and the man who claimed to meet Deanne at the knitting factory all refused to answer calls from any of the family and have even blocked them on Facebook. Just what in the hell are these people hiding? Unfortunately, we may never know, but we can hope that at some point something is found or one of these people grows a conscience. They probably have told someone or mentioned it in a drunken stupor one night. Somebody must know. And they could do so much to ease a family's pain by just speaking. They don't even have to go and tell the police. They could call in an anonymous tip. Yet, 3 years later, and it's all silence. The vanishing of Deanne Hastings is a heartbreaking, frustrating, difficult, and painful story to tell. A beautiful young mother, ready to go to school, to create a future, to marry a man she loves, and who is so excited about being around her children again, just disappears. The last people seen with her refuse to give answers, and without more information or evidence, authorities have no leverage with which to apply pressure. For Deanne's family, every day that passes is another missed opportunity, and another time where they imagine their phone could ring at any moment, and it could be Deanne. Or it could be the police with a horrifying revelation. Until someone comes forward, new evidence is found, or Deanne herself turns up, the vanishing of Deanne Hastings remains open, unsolved, and getting colder every day. If you're looking for more information about the disappearance of Deanne Hastings, Disappeared did an episode on her case. There are some online articles and forum posts about it, but to be totally honest, there is not a vast wealth of information about this case out there. If you have any information about the vanishing of Deanne Hastings, please contact the Spokane Crime Check at area code 509-477-2233. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. This year, CrimeCon will be held in New Orleans from June 7th through the 9th. Amidst exciting presentations and inspiring discussions, I'm really looking forward to attending and representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. If you're planning to attend but haven't yet purchased your pass, you can save 10% by using the promo code TRACE19. Simply visit crimecon.com, select a standard pass, and use the code TRACE19. That's TRACE19 to save 10% today. I look forward to seeing you there. A special shout out goes out to Patreon producers Alicia Lorraine, Krista Colvin, Deani Dyson, Eamon Brady, Kate Alexander, Megan, Chandra Moreau, and Tara Doble. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence. Visit trace-evidence.com for all episodes, social media links, merchandise, and more. I want to thank you all for listening to this episode, and remind you that if you're planning to attend CrimeCon in New Orleans, to use the promo code TRACE19 for 10% off a standard badge. I'll be on Podcast Row and can't wait to meet all of you. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.